Let's see if that looks good. That looks good. Seems to be working, this thing. All right, we're off to the races.
Let's test.
Great, fantastic. So, I'm fine. I'm on lots of. Oh yeah, let's go this way first a little bit because I need to refill my water, and then we'll just turn around. But like I mentioned, I'm on lots of pain medication, so I'll let you do most of the talking.
Oh, thanks, man.
And I'll just chill. I'll just chill and listen.
Great.
So yeah, tell me all about it. Like, I was quite surprised to see you sign up for Sovereign Engineering and actually be here. I mean, I obviously know about you and your work. You've been working on ASMAP.
Yep.
So maybe, I don't know, you pick and choose. What would be a good entry point to start of kind of...
Well, why were you surprised?
I don't know. Lots of Bitcoin people don't care too much about Nostr and the stuff we're doing here. And I consider you like very deep into Bitcoin technicalities and those kind of things.
Oh, I don't know about that.
And I don't know. How did you end up working on ASMAP in the first place? Like, how did that go?
Yeah, so I was, I've been interested in Bitcoin for a long time, and I was always trying to find ways to contribute, but I never really, you know, I'm a dev, but I've never done C++, and I don't really want to either. And I never really found stuff I could contribute to in core that I thought was very meaningful. But I went to a BTC++ in Berlin in 2023. That was Nix edition, right? And so I had happened to do a fair amount. I went down the Nix rabbit hole.
You were a Nix guy before that.
I was a Nix guy. Yeah, right. I was a Nix guy. And somehow during the COVID lockdowns, I ended up, just in my house and learned a ton about Nix. Went way too far into it. Like, approached madness and stepped back from the brink, you know?
Awesome.
And Lisa chose to do a BTC++ on Nix, which I thought was super cool and super random. And so she invited me to do a talk. So I did a talk in Berlin. And I met Fabian Yar, who was, a longtime contributor in Bitcoin. He's done a ton of work on plenty of different things. And we were just chatting, and he was like, I have this problem with this project I'm working on. And I'm trying to make sure, because a lot of people have to run this software together, but I need to make sure their dependencies are the same and that they're reproducible, so we can be sure about the reproducibility and etc.
Yeah, you can see that in the GitHub issues, right? Like, everyone is running the thing and reporting the result of the runs now.
Right. Yeah. So we do this collaborative run thing with ASMAP that we can get into the ASMAP process and whatever, where we all kind of run ASMAP together and see what the output is. And so to do that correctly, you have to at least have the same software and the same dependencies and make sure we're on the same version, et cetera. And so Nix was a good solution to that, right? So after that conversation, I kind of poked at ASMAP, tried to understand what it was and started contributing here and there to ASMAP. I was kind of moving countries and in between 14 different things over the next handful of months, but started contributing to the project a little more. And there was a lot to do. It was one of those things where it was kind of a big... So I should maybe take a step back here. The thing I'm talking about is this program called Cartograph, which creates ASMAPs, right?
And that's for those people who don't know what ASMAPs are.
Yeah, so, I mean, I can give the whole... We can get into what ASMAP is, because it's a cool story, and it's been part of Core for a while. So ASMAP is a feature of Bitcoin Core, and it's been included as a feature since about Core 20. So it's been some time. And it was started by Gleb Naumenko, and then a lot of people contributed to it. I think Sipa, Virtu, and a handful of other people over the years. And where it came from was to realize kind of an observation that Gleb had at the time, which was the way a Bitcoin Core node peers with the network, with other peers. The node keeps track of all its other peers and other addresses, right? And
you mean IP addresses?
IP addresses, right? Yeah. Or Tor addresses or other transports, but let's stick to the ClearNet example, right? Because that's where ASMAP is relevant. It would be unfortunate if you started your Bitcoin Core node and you connected to mostly peers that were in the same AWS data center, the same Hetzner data center. We want this to be decentralized. And so
Yeah, in part, this would be problematic because that would be one easy way to Sybil attack someone, right?
Right. So, the problem we're trying to avoid is that your node gets Sybil attacks, or that you get eclipsed from the network, we sometimes say, right? So that means that, you know, a malicious attacker manages to control all your peers and feeds you this like alternate view of the network.
Yeah.
And you're no longer on the Bitcoin network. You're on kind of a fake mirror world that your attacker has created for you.
Yeah, right? Everyone you attack to is a malicious actor and tries to fool you. So you have no way of actually knowing about that if every single person you're connected to is part of the bad bunch.
Right.
That's the issue.
Yeah, like we want, you know, the peer-to-peer network should be the Wild West.
Hello! You'll have a guest appearance.
Yes.
Big hug. Say
just
hi.
To a friend. Hello.
Hello.
How's it going?
Good, perfect. I sleep almost all day, but I'm super good now.
Guest appearance to the show by Sherry.
Yeah, we are recording a recorded dialogue right now. So if I would have a third microphone, I'd clip it onto you and you could join, but unfortunately I don't have a third.
Oh, okay.
So we'll have to.
Okay. Oh, I didn't know this. Okay, wait.
Yeah, we look like regular people.
Are you guys going to cut this part? Or
no,
gonna...
no, there's no edits. Cutting.
Oh,
no. There's no edits. There's
my
no edits.
Just roll with it. Roll with it.
I'm going to listen.
So we'll continue and you'll cool. Just, where do you need to go? I can help you.
I'm going to find my flatmate.
Okay.
Yoro. I still have difficulties to pronounce his name.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you went down here. You might... No, that's right.
But yeah, how can I still continue going down?
Yeah. Just go that way. You go ahead.
Okay.
And we stay in the shade a little bit.
Okay.
And then we see... Because if you get lost again, we can help you.
Definitely.
Okay.
No problem.
You go ahead and try to find your way and we'll catch up with you.
And don't cut it.
All right. No, I won't. Don't worry. Bye-bye.
The No Solutions podcast.
Fantastic.
Where we help people find their way.
We were talking about her today already because, you know, like the female participant rate in the Sovereign Engineering cohorts is steadily increasing.
Is it?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, we went from 0 to 1.
Okay.
Big moment.
There you go.
So
breaking out anytime soon.
So we are on the beginning of an exponential curve.
Oh, that's how you calculate that.
Yeah. Let's see how it goes.
GG, optimistic math, my friend.
Very optimistic math.
Very nice.
Yeah, so we were the goal of ASMAP is to... protect users from Eclipse attacks, right? Is that fair, kind of?
Yeah, exactly. That's the goal, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously, like, the way Core is set up is meant to help with this, right? You know, the way we manage, we learn about a lot of peers, and we learn about a lot of peers through other peers.
Yeah.
And so we have a very large number of addresses on our core nodes. I mean, usually, I don't know, between 40 and 50,000, something like that. And maybe you're actively connected to a much smaller subset at a time and getting information from them.
But it's just to make it clear how hard that problem is, because we still have, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's still, you need to seed the initial connection somehow, right? So you need to start from a trusted seed in some sense and then you branch out from there. There is no other sensible way of doing it in a decentralized network without an authority, basically. So
or having a very long bootstrap time where you crawl the network without interacting with it beyond just like gathering information about peers or something, right? Like
you can
do some stuff, but it'd all be quite annoying.
And
the DNS bootstrap seed thing in Core is, I mean, I don't know. It's the best solution we came up with. I wouldn't say it's optimal, right? We still trust a set of seeds to start our peer bootstrapping, right? So it's a hard problem for sure. And this is nothing to do with, like, you know, Byzantine generals problem or whatever, right? We're just talking about like connecting to peers and not getting eclipsed. That's it. They're two separate kind of.
Yeah. It has nothing to do with consensus in that sense.
Right.
Nothing like that.
Nothing to do with that.
Networking peer-to-peer, yeah.
Yeah, so like, you know, your core node has this thing we call it's called Adderman in the code. It's just like your address manager that stores information about peers. And the thing it does where it buckets your peers into, little buckets, right? And the way it does it is that it takes the first like two octets of your IPv4 address, let's say. So, you know, the two numbers after the dot, the first two numbers. And that's a bucket. So we say anybody in this network, given your IP address, you get put in the same bucket. We'll pretend if you're, you know, 12.2 and everyone with addresses that start like that, get put in the same bucket, right?
Yeah, and the reason for that is because if you would be in the same AWS data center without doing any additional fancy IP address masking or anything like that, you would have assigned, you would automatically end up in the same bucket, right?
Right. And so what's the assumption that, you know, networks are controlled by same entities, right?
Yeah.
So, and it's a good heuristic, and it works well for most of the internet because that's how the internet works, right?
Yeah.
And obviously, I mean, some networks are bigger than that, some networks are smaller than that. but that held true for most of the internet. It's a perfectly fine heuristic, like it works, right?
Yeah.
There's the internet has kind of changed a bit over the last 15 years in that. So first I should say that like the way that the internet works is that you have regional registrars that control IP address space, right? So Europe has this thing called RIPE, US has ARIN, Asia is APNIC or whatever, and they partition the internet amongst themselves, and then they go to entities that, and they give them to like say Cloudflare or Amazon or whatever, and then Amazon goes and gives them to their customers or consumers or universities, individuals, whatever, right? Yeah. And these entities that enter into a contractual relationship with their regional registrar is called an AS, an autonomous system, right? So they're called autonomous systems. So that's why it's called ASMAP. And so these ASs can control lots of different networks. They don't have to control just one, right? Mm-hmm. So like Cloudflare A has like multiple ASs because they're really big, and so does Google, and so does Amazon. But they can also own networks that aren't contiguous, right? They can say, I want 12.2/16 and all the stuff below it, but I also want 100.11, whatever. And so if you just looked at the IP addresses, you wouldn't know that they're the same entity, right? So you can imagine where, like, in core, this might be a problem, right? Because if you're...
A sophisticated Sybil attacker might split it up across there.
Well, or
the things they control.
Yeah, or the AS is the attacker themselves,
yeah.
Right? Or the government knocks on the door of the ASs and says, let's hijack the traffic,
yeah.
Right? So this observation that multiple, like ASs could have multiple subnetworks, and also the fact that they were trading them more often. Like if you looked at just how different ASs trade, like...
IP address ranges and zones.
Yeah, they break them up, they trade them, and it's happening more frequently than it used to.
Interesting,
right?
Okay.
So we're having trouble keeping a static map of the internet valid, you know, like 20 years ago or even like, you know, I don't know. 30 years ago, for sure, it was less of a problem. But today,
you could map it out once, and you would be fine for a long while.
Yeah,
and now it's more, a way more dynamic process mapping it out.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. The idea with AS map was okay. Well, what we really want to do is map who owns these networks, like who has the control.
Yeah.
From a entity standpoint, over individual peers, and so that's what we're trying to do. What AS map is doing is using. Is building maps between the IP net. Instead of using IP networks, we use the autonomous system. So we create maps of who owns what IP networks, and then we bucket the peers in your peers by AS and not by IP address, right? Mm-hmm. So we change the whole like peering code itself to no longer respect it does a bit of both, but it can also do by AS if it has an AS map to use.
Okay.
And that's considered superior, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Goal of the ASMAP is to be an extra security for your peering system.
So you wanna, with what you just described, you basically build up the connections, and I want one peer from this zone, and one peer from this zone, and one peer from this zone, and so on.
Right.
And you can define the, like you said, you can initiate a connection based on the AS as the main criteria.
Well, it's more like when you hear about a peer and, you know, you get its IP address, or you're, in this case, it's AS, or in this case, both, it says, oh, you know what, like, I would get this AS 123 that is Hetzner or whatever, and you know what, that bucket's full.
Yeah.
If it was your IP address, okay,
you don't establish the connection in the first place.
Right. Well, so you might. Yeah. Or, you know, you'll keep filling up the bucket until it's until it's full. Mm-hmm. And so you'll say, okay, you go in this AS because you're Hetzner clearly.
Yeah.
Or something else, right?
Yeah.
And so the idea is that it's much harder to do that, like to control entire autonomous systems, than it is to control an individual IP network.
Yeah.
Right? So we're elevating the cost of attack of a peer, the cost of a peering attack, right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so that's the idea, right? Then this has existed, you know, all this backend code and core has existed for a long time. It's been, you know, 20 was in, I think, 2020, maybe earlier. But the whole problem with this is how do you actually build these maps? Mm-hmm. Like, how do you build a map of the internet?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a problem that kind of dragged along for a while because it's quite difficult to do. And the answer is, well, it's not really possible to, like, do it correctly or, like, fully, right? Because there's no real address book for the internet.
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't exist, you know? So Fabian went on a bunch of big research bents to kind of like figure out how to do this optimally. Like, we went to network research conferences and everybody was like, no, forget about it, you can't do it. But, you know, so, you know, in the spirit of no solutions, only trade-offs, we came up with, so you started working on this project called Cartograph, right? And mm-hmm. Cartograph with a K is a Python program that fetches information about who owns what AS and tries to merge it as optimally as possible, like given the trade-offs of what we think is valid. And I can go more deeply into the how of how we assemble these maps if that's interesting, but you know, it's basically we try to build these maps up as sanely as possible. And as of the last core release, we're now embedding an AS map into core directly.
Yeah,
so it's not on by default, but if you add like AS map on, or I can't remember where the setting is, then we'll use the default AS map that we embed with the releases of
Yeah.
core.
Why was the immediate reaction from the network guys, it's impossible basically, and don't do it? Like, what's the main issue that you run into? What is it that makes it impossible?
So there's no like authenticated way to prove that you own an IP network. So the way that, like, you know, the internet is a network of networks.
Yeah.
And the way that we find IP addresses on the internet is that there's all these routers that point you in the right direction, right?
Yeah.
So these are called BGP routers,
yeah.
Border Gateway Protocol,
yeah.
Right? And BGP sucks, you know, BGP sucks a
yeah.
lot. And there are quote unquote attacks, but it's really just how BGP works is that you can just announce whatever you want, right? And routers
yeah.
will just like replicate it unless they have like extra checks behind to try to ensure, or like, you know, have someone to call and say, is this really your network, right? And so there have been plenty of documented attacks by...
Yeah, yeah, I remember. We had some big internet outages a while ago related to BGP. 15 years ago or something. I still remember that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I did all my networking classes at university and so on. So long, long ago, my BGP knowledge is like very bad.
Yeah.
but that's what I still remember.
That no worries.
It's one of the Achilles heels, basically. Like, if you want to bring stuff down... And just you know, like, cause a bunch of ruckus. BGP is
a way to go. Yeah,
with a way to go. Yeah.
Yeah, and luckily, like, you know, obviously this is like a known problem, and a lot of people, like, all the operators of the internet are well aware of the problem set. And there's been a lot of thought about how to do it better, right? So it's hard to pull off. These attacks are visible immediately, I guess, is one way.
Mm.
The other part is that people have tried to come up with solutions to this. So there's stuff like BGPSec, which is kind of I don't really know much about it, but it's part of making BGP better. The thing we use a lot in Cartograph is this thing called RPKI. So I'm sorry, I'm throwing like a ton of acronyms.
No,
but that is just like the way the internet is. It's just alphabet soup, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So,
I mean, PKI, people should know what PKI stands for. What's the R?
So it's resource public key infrastructure.
Okay.
RPKI is basically a way for... regional internet registrars like Ripe and Aaron to attest that a certain AS is authorized to advertise a route.
Mm-hmm.
So effectively, we have like a public key infrastructure around publishing announcements that say, okay, I'm, you know, AS 444, and I'm allowed to advertise these internet routes.
Right.
And so you have a public attestation that is verifiable against the RIR's public key and this
mm-hmm.
thing called a trust anchor.
Yeah.
And anybody can just like hook up to RPKI servers and check that all this stuff is
mm-hmm.
valid,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is really good. And it's got some limitations and some, you know, soft spots, but it's already a huge leap forward in like our ability to verify the
At least you have cryptographic assurances. Of course, the PKI infrastructure is still permissioned and those kind of things. Right.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so anybody can pull down from it. Like the RPKI servers are decentralized,
so
you know, anybody can just. There's a multiple programs you can use to go verify RPKI information. So the problem is that RPKI is kind of under. Well, it's being rolled out, and so it covers about 55% of the internet today.
Okay.
Which is good.
Surprisingly good.
Yes.
Like usually if you roll something new out, like IPv6 had this issue for the longest time, it still has it, right?
Yeah.
Like it has been around forever, but you know, like the internet doesn't like to change.
Yeah. Indeed. Like herding goats. But that's kind of like our basis for Cartograph. It's like what we use to be the kind of bedrock of AS map, of how we map an AS to an autonomous system. Is that we go through all the RPKI info, we validate it, and then we take those routes and those ASs, and that's the basis of our map.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah.
Tell me more about kind of what I briefly mentioned before. There's all these GitHub issues where various people run certain things and basically everyone needs to arrive at the same result. What's that about? Explain this to people.
Right, so every month or so, we do something called a collaborative run, which is where we all decide on a certain Unix timestamp, you know, a certain second that we're gonna launch this cartograph program at. And the goal is to see if we can arrive at the exact same AS map on the other side, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, like for our PKI, it's a decentralized set of servers. We're connecting to a bunch of servers around the world, and we're fetching all this RPKI data, we're validating it, we're building it into a map. And we're also, since it's only 55% of the internet, we're also pulling other information from other public databases that are not cryptographically verified, right? And we want to aggregate what we don't have. And so, doing all those things, we want to see if it's possible to get to a final map that is correct. Mm-hmm. And that works. I mean, usually there are certain things like, oh, like a route changed right the second we did this, so some of you got it and some of you didn't. Or like straight up, like we failed to connect to some servers or whatever.
Yeah.
But we're able to see like how different the maps are. And most of the time, you know, we gauge like, okay, 50% of the run, if we have more than five or six people running, and we get to 50% of people that have the same map.
Yeah.
You know, and we look at maps that are really divergent to see like what the problem is. So,
I looked at the output. I was surprised that from the issues I looked at, most people got the same output. I was like, oh wow, that's amazing. It actually works.
You know, it really depends. Some months don't go so well, and some months are really easy, and you know, almost everyone gets it, and it's cool. We built some better tooling these days to kind of try to see the differences between maps, and they're usually pretty minor. So I mean, like the idea of doing this is A, to give assurance to ourselves that like cartograph is a reliable way of building these AS maps,
yeah,
which we're pretty confident with now, and you know, we can inspect them or whatever. Yeah. And the other is to ensure that, you know, especially when we embed it into core, that we the map we give core was not just like YOLO'd on someone's computer, right? Yeah. It's that multiple people have done this. Yeah. We've looked at the map, like we got the exact same hash output. This wasn't like invented by me. Right?
And there is a, you know, like cryptographically verifiable paper trail, so to speak, like how this map came about, right?
Yeah. And you know, I've thought about, you know, how can we Nostrify this? Or like, you know, what if we did, you know, broader publication of hashes and everybody like hid their hash but only revealed it together at the same time to make sure there was
machine, I see.
You know, like, there's all sorts of fun stuff you can do here. But for us, GitHub is the paper trail, and that's
sure. I mean, you know, one step at a time. You know, one step at a time.
So I mean, you know, anybody can join. Like hop in or one of our collaborative runs. You really just have to like run, like set the program to run at the time, and it's one flag, you know.
Yeah,
and it just does the thing, and you get an AS map at the end, and that's it.
Awesome. Yeah. I'll definitely put stuff in the show notes so people can join and participate. Yeah. I think it's a fun little thing to do. Very, very low barrier of entry. Very low cost.
Super low barrier.
Run one command, paste the output.
Yeah. And you know, it's like we had this debate about AS mapping core a lot because, you know, I was kind of the bent of like, well, you know, the feature's there. Like, if people won't just go build their own AS maps when it's this easy, I don't know if they're ever going to. Like, we're gonna have to embed it into core for them to use it.
Yeah.
But I really wish people would just like, whenever you spin up a new version of core, you just, you know, snap a new AS map that's fresh off the presses for yourself.
Hmm.
And just use it. Like, you can do it. You don't have to wait for core or for us or for anybody to build one for you.
Yeah. I see. Yeah, but it's kind of an esoteric topic. Very few like hardcore Bitcoin users will care about it in some senses.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, it's
definitely, I mean, it's a niche subject.
Yeah, for sure. So how come you already spoke about, you thought about, you know, Nostrifying some of those things? How did you bump into Nostr, and what has you kind of excited about it? And also important to me personally, how did you bump into sovereign engineering? How come you discovered the whole thing and decided to sign up, and you're here now?
Yeah.
Always blows me away that people actually come. You know, like there's nothing in it for you, just hanging out in Madeira for a couple of weeks, basically, talking.
I think there's a lot in it for you. That's pretty fun. No one come, guys. This is already plenty fun. Don't join sovereign engineering. Nostr. I mean, I was. I think the first person I heard about it from was probably Will Casserin. When I was following him on Twitter, and you know, he's always hacking together fun stuff. I was looking at, I think, his like Ellen socket work or whatever.
Yeah.
And just poking around his little prototypes, which are always super fun, and you learn a lot from just listening to what Will Kasserin outputs. And he started poking at Noster, and I was like, okay, like, what's this Noster thing? And I read, yeah, Fiat Jobs, like, one pager on it, and it was just, like, a good example of, like, something that was thought so clearly, so well exposed, and I was like, ah, oh, thank you. And it seemed to me that it was, like, it was at the right time where everyone was trying to find the next social media because Twitter was kind of a mess
yeah.
at the time.
Yeah.
And it just came with, like, oh, someone finally saw clearly, like, you know, the right mix of clients and servers and...
Yeah, the right trade-offs, kind of, right?
The right trade-offs, right?
Right primitives, right trade-offs.
It's such a... It's funny, like, when you deal with, like, technical solutions like this, you can almost feel when the thing is right. You just read it and you're like, immediately, I know this is exactly it, you know? So I just watched it. You know, I was like, where's this thing going? Like, I'll make a little profile and I'll start listening and seeing what happens on Noster. You know, what are Bitcoiners going to come up with? You know, maybe it goes nowhere and in half a month or half a year, it, you know, people fizzle out or whatever. Yeah. And the exact opposite happened.
It's dying right now. Haven't you heard? It's dying right now. Noster is dead.
Yeah,
if the Noster hive mind is to believe, it's dying right now.
Yeah.
The same with Bitcoin. It's dying all the time.
We're off on a little island in the middle of the Atlantic. They just can't find us.
Yeah,
they don't know we're here. And like honestly, over the years, just like watching the experimentation and the like breakneck pace of experimentation that happened on Noster, right? And I was just like, this is how I like to social. You know, like I don't want to be back on Twitter.
Yeah.
Like I've been off most social media. I think there was only one I had And I was like, yeah, this is where me and my friends can hang out. Even if it's only just us, this is perfectly fun for me, you know? And it has not disappointed, you know? So for me, it's like the exact right primitive we can build on, and people have done so in ways that still blow my mind every day. And I think the future is very bright.
What's your daily driver right now? What's your Noster usage look like?
I really wish it was better, but my daily driver is just Amethyst.
All right. I mean, same. Guilty as charged.
Yeah. I just like...
kitchen sink client for the win.
Yeah, exactly right. My phone almost takes off and leaves for the next room every time I open Amethyst. But it's great. I mean, it's a great mobile app, etc. I wish there were better like desktop clients. I never found one I really loved.
Yeah.
I don't really want to log into the web for Noster. Like, I'd really like to...
Yeah,
just keep it on my
I use Noster, which is actually an iOS client on my desktop. Since I'm on macOS, you can use the iOS apps as well.
Okay.
So that kind of works for me, but I agree, like the desktop clients are subpar. Like I'm very close to building my own. Very, very close.
Oh, wait, you know, I might do this summer engineering. We'll see.
All right. Yeah, please nerd snipe me on it. Like I really don't want to. And the other desktop client I use is Co-op, but that's just for NIP17, just to talking to my agents warm, basically.
Yeah.
And those days are numbered probably as well, because I'll probably, you know, follow Pablo's path and switch to NIP29 group chats and so on.
Mm.
But we'll see. Do you use, are you iOS or Android?
Android.
Do you use SAP Store a lot?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Huge SAP Store fan.
Okay.
Awesome. Friends app, shout out. We never met, but dude, I love you. You
know? Yeah, I know. He's fantastic.
Yeah.
And friends, SAP Store, because it's one of my main Noster use cases. It's like I get a new phone, I install SAP Store, and I'm off to the races, and I love it so much.
Yeah.
And for me, it's kind of like I'm at a point now, if it isn't on SAP Store, it doesn't exist for me. You know? Like I probably don't need the app.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it's awesome in that way.
Yeah, and it's got a bright future ahead too. Like there's plenty of things left to build on the whole distribution of apps and whatever. So I mean, you know, what's funny about Noster is like, I don't think I've ever been more bullish on Noster than right now. I know I say this, I probably say this a lot, but...
Now like, in the Noster bear market, how dare you?
Oh no, I'm so bullish, dude. Like the Git thing alone, like Jack is so right to push on this, that we should be rebuilding GitHub on Noster.
Yeah.
And the way his new Buzz thing that he just released is kind of in that
direction. Oh, it's happening.
And
Did you look into Nget and Git Workshop?
Deeply.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna probably build some stuff on it. This
awesome.
Cohort.
Yeah. Awesome.
We needed to get off Twitter at some point.
To get off. No, it's coming. It's coming. I myself, I'm very close to this transition. Like because Like, I've been using GitHub forever. Like, my just like with, like, I deleted my Twitter profile when I was like 15 years old or so. And this is similar for my GitHub account. Like, it's ancient. Mm. And the reason why I deleted my Twitter was Nasta was there and it was good enough. And I hated Twitter more and more. And the same thing's happening right now to me and GitHub, my relationship with GitHub. It's like a toxic, abusive relationship. And I feel like GitHub is abusing me all day, every day. Yeah. It just gets worse and worse and worse. Stuff that always used to work is breaking. And it's time I jump ship and go Nostr only for my Git stuff as well. Yeah. I'm not 100% ready yet to pull the trigger because
it's not all
I rely on it. I rely on it so much, and every time I tried to go purely Nostr based, I always ran into issues and always something was missing that I needed. But it is gonna get there. Like I can feel it in my plums.
Oh, no doubt.
kind
no
of thing.
Doubt.
We're close.
And the thing that's interesting with GitHub is like you have to unbundle a bunch of things, right? Because you have like the actual, okay, this is just where like my Git repo lives and people can push and pull to it. It's where I read files and where I interact with code and then like explore it.
Yeah.
There's CI, which is a huge reason why people get locked into GitHub.
Yes.
There's the social part, which to me is also super important of like, I actually really love in GitHub being able to just follow people and see what they push or what they're working on.
I follow so many people and like the star thing, like Justin Moon was talking about this as well. It's such a big signal, you know, all those little things are so important.
And so we have to either like, you know, unbundle and rebundle.
Issue tracking pull requests, of course.
Yeah, all
that
those
stuff.
Kind
of thing.
All that stuff.
Yeah. Releases. And,
but the social thing will be really interesting too. Yeah. Like, what are the parts of GitHub social that we can reinvent on Nostr primitives that work? Like, what works with GitHub that we should keep, right?
Yeah.
Like there's Git Dev Workshop, which is kind of like let's get exactly the GitHub UI, like try to get to parity, like we did with the early Nostr clients.
Yeah.
Like, let's try to get to parity with what exists.
Yeah.
And then build from there, right?
Yeah.
Which is awesome. Like, shout out Dan Conway. You know, like works awesome.
Yeah.
But I would like to see more different UIs. Like,
Marty Malmy is building his own thing as well.
Is he?
Yeah, he has a Git interface. I think even Justin built his own.
Cool.
Git interface, basically, just with the features he needs.
Why not?
So it's definitely happening. And cool to see also that you looked into it.
I think about it for Core a lot, right? Because it's come up over the years here and there. And like, you know, Core has good resilience plans. Like, if GitHub shut us out tomorrow, like, what would Core do?
Yeah.
And there's mirrors. You know, people are backed up all the issues, the pull requests, the history, CI. There have been some movement in different directions. But, you know, if CI went out tomorrow, we could rebuild it fairly quickly, I think.
Yeah.
At least for Linux. But yeah, like, you know, Bitcoin is one of the most important software projects in history, and it should probably not be dependent on Microsoft company, you know? And I agreed, like, the infra work around Core is, like, humongous.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, they're going to have to figure out a solution to move towards it.
Step by step.
Yeah.
I mean, same for, you know, there were discussions around the mailing list as well, you know, like the using the mailing list as a communication hub and, you know, getting booted off of certain providers and so on. And like,
well, you know, I think I would like to see Core like push more towards like be further on the edge of like, we're going to try to do it right and like be as independent as possible instead of, you know, GitHub and Google being our crutches until they kick us out.
I think it's bound to happen. It's just kind of a matter of time. And you also have to be a little bit pragmatic about the choices as well.
Definitely.
You know, like it has to work.
Yeah.
Like if it makes everyone like only half as productive, then it's a really bad move.
So I mean, another thing like on that train of thought about GitHub over Nostr is like, is, I don't know about you, but for me, LLMs on having the copilot in GitHub has been really nice. Like, it has changed the way I interact with repositories distinctly. Right. So like, when I have any question about a repo or like, not even like, where's this file, but like, where's the part of this code base where this logic happens, or like, does this do what I think it does, or etc. I don't bother. Like,
and you use Copilot directly on the GitHub interface, or?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they give it to you for free, right? They have never rate limited me of asking questions on there.
Yeah.
It's not a fairly advanced
I've
model.
I've never used it. I do the same thing, but I always use my own stuff. I'm almost never in the GitHub interface.
So you clone locally and then ask questions about it?
I have a swarm of agents and I just paste the link to a repo and like tell me about.
Okay, you're further ahead than I am. Yeah. You have to show me your ways.
Yeah.
But But I think what I was going to get at was like, you know, there's an opportunity for whoever rebuilds GitHub. I mean, that's basically what Jack did with Buzz, right? Is like get agents plus Git in one interface and see what happens.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really good move. Really good move.
Yeah, it's the right move. I had a long conversation today with Pablo about all this, and basically the you just mentioned, you know, like show me your ways. My ways are very simple. I'm a very simple man. I want to be in front of the computer for as little time as possible.
Amen.
So all my stuff has to be mobile first, and basically what I landed on is like I use NIP 17 to DM my agents. The agents run in various harnesses that are various systems underneath, basically mostly OpenClaw still, just because like I set it up when it kind of came out and I still like it, and it does everything I need to do.
Okay.
And so for the thing you described, if I wanna like I open any Nostra client, doesn't matter, Amethyst, doesn't Wisp is more reliable on NIP17 DM, so Wisp mostly for that, and on the desktop I use CoOp and so on, and I just, you know, I pick my, I have one, it's called Sovereign Sven, and he knows all about the sovereign tech I'm interested in.
Okay.
And I will paste in the GitHub link or repo link, whatever, it doesn't matter. You know, it can be GitLab, Gitia, whatever, plain, also hosted on Nostra repo. It's like, tell me more about this. What's the most interesting feature of this thing? And so on. And then I just go back and forth, and I'm on my phone or whatever.
Yeah.
Also text-to-speech and voice and so on, like this stuff works. So these are my ways,
because
then I can do it here, you know? Like I walk up and down, or I'm at the beach, and I'll do this stuff and not stare into a screen all the time.
Yeah, so it's almost like GitHub just died on its own. Like, no, everyone just like walks out of the interface, and like if you have agents, and if you have Git servers.
That's part of the agentic world. The death of UI is part of the agentic world. I think it's one of the very logical consequences.
You think voice will become the primary interface?
I think the differentiation between text and speech will continue to blur. It definitely has for me, but I also realize that I'm an insane person and you know,
you're just ahead of the curve.
That's dropped off of the curve a long time ago. But to me, it kind of doesn't matter. For some things, voice is way better. Like if you have, the good thing about writing is it really helps you think. It helps you to distill your thoughts.
Yep.
The good thing about a long rambling session is like if you don't even know what the problem is, you just talking into a microphone for like 15 minutes while you're walking is like fantastic. And LLMs are insanely good at distilling the essence of it and so on. And so one of my workflows, just to stick with the example you posted, like new repo, I want to figure out, I don't know how BitChat works or whatever. Okay, there's this new thing. And I paste it in, like, look at this repo. And then in the same session, like same chat, basically, same agent, everything. So we'll have a good overview. And then I'll ask a follow-up question in a long, rambly voice note, you know? And I just go like, that sounds interesting. Tell me more about, you know, like the way it utilizes Bluetooth or the way it utilizes NPUFS, like what is an identity in BitChat and so on, and what else I might come up with. And that's it. I hit send, and then 5 minutes later, I get a text message back. I might use, you know, like the phone can also read it to me and so on. And so that's, I think the line between text to speech will continue to blur. And I know it does also for Pablo, for example, who is even more insane than me, and he will have all his agents work on stuff as autonomously as possible, and then one of the agents will go over all the work and produce a podcast episode, and his podcast player will just pop up, oh, you know, like daily update of what happened. So
is Pablo even living his own life anymore, you know?
No, like, no, he made himself a cog in the machine, and Pablo, what the machine is doing, no one knows. What's the goal of the machine, no one knows.
Did you see what you pushed last night? No. What did I push last night? No idea.
No, it's really funny. So he's very close to the peak of AI psychosis, I think, but he's not at the peak yet. So
damn.
We'll see.
Wild. You know, one thing I was thinking about with like speech and text interfaces was, you know, one interface that has not changed with computers in like 50 fucking years is keyboard and mouse.
Mm, yeah.
You know, we've been stuck with like graphical terminals and typey-typey on the keyboard and like move a little mouse around your little GUI as the default mode of how most of humanity deals with computing,
Yeah.
right? And I think the fact that we have LLMs and we can do like voice, speech, text, is going to radically change the nature of like interfaces with computers for society as a whole, right? Not just devs.
Yeah.
I think it's a pretty massive change.
No, that's definitely happening. And also what Fiat Jeff, for example, doesn't understand is like 98% of the human population that interfaces with compute interfaces on the mobile phone. And so that most people don't have computers anymore. Like everyone just has a phone. And the
phones are
computers. It's still, you know, point and click, basically, but the interface has definitely evolved, like, to all the buttons are bigger, you know, the interfaces are smaller, mobile friendly, and so on. And I think the next step of this evolution will definitely be kind of, people just will have a, it's already happening with AirPods and so on, tiny earplug in, or also with, like, everything dematerializes further. You have your watch, you know, your smartwatch, it can display some things. You have something in your ear that can whisper to you. And I think that's just where it's heading. It's very natural. Also, some of these rings, the, you know, the Pebble smartwatch?
Yeah.
The guy who built the Pebble smartwatch, he's building a ring now. And the ring has one single button, and all it does is record a voice note.
Okay.
So basically, that will be one of the input interfaces where you just go like, you know, 20-second voice note, and it will go to your phone and do things and so on.
I think, you know, some of this, it's not quite like, the thing that's nice about computers and less so on mobile is that they are not on us or around us, right? You have to go to a desk and like interact with the machine.
Yeah.
And yes, it's frustrating. And
no, I
yes,
get what you
mean.
Deal
with it. But then like, and so like the first instinct for people with AI is like, okay, can I like wear it? Can I have it, you know, in my ear? Can I have it in my glasses? Can I have it on my ring?
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's going to stick, right? Like, I don't think people like that. I mean, some people are like really into it, and I've seen a lot more wearable AI stuff in the last 6 months than I have in forever. But I wonder if people will not always want computing to be outside of themselves. Like, if we had little, if we had drones that could be solar powered and just follow us around all day, I think people would much prefer that with their AI than they would to have something on them at all times.
I think I know what you mean. Like for me as well, especially if I start a new project, I need to go into the workshop and hammer on the thing intensely for like a couple hours.
Yeah.
And do really like rapid iterations and be really close to the matter and literally be in the workshop. There is no other way. I can't do it on the go. I can't do it from my phone and so on. It doesn't work. However, once I'm in maintenance mode, for example, and someone reports a bug and it's, you know, one of my agents fixed it and I just have to look over it and press merge, I can do that on my phone. Or get a briefing, like a daily briefing or something, some summary of stuff that happened. I'm fine with, you know, getting that on mobile or even in voice message format at the end of the day or something like that.
Sure, sure, sure.
So kind of, you know, right tool for the job kind of thing.
Yeah. You could imagine like your phone become, I mean, they're not even phones anymore, right? No one, they're not telephones.
Yeah, no one's using their phone for phone purposes.
I mean, we still have, you know, however many gigs of memory and phone plan and data plan, whatever.
It's a full-blown supercomputer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So like if everything is remote and it's just like your agent texting you what's up all the time or telling you, like giving you little yes or no prompts or whatever, how small can the phone be, right?
Yeah.
How much can we remove from this idea of a smartphone?
Hey! Next hey, guest appearance.
Another guest appearance.
Recording.
Yeah, we're recording. I'll see you around.
Yeah,
take care, man. Small island.
Yeah. Gigi's just pretending he's not that popular, but he is.
No,
he
small, is. Really small island.
We have to chase away his fans. That's crazy.
Bitcoin engineer, obviously. Yeah. Really good guy.
Cool.
Yeah, he did lots of Lightning infrastructure stuff.
No shit.
Yeah. Like really deep into the weeds. Cool. Yeah, you wouldn't guess it if you see him, right? Like he looks more like a CrossFit type of person or something.
But oh, Bitcoiners, man, we're all shapes and sizes and we're everywhere. It's crazy.
Yeah, really cool. Yeah, let's see how it evolves on the computing side. I mean, it's definitely exciting times. Everyone has some level of AI psychosis. Mm. Stuff is moving really fast.
Do you have any like sci-fi references that you think about when you think of AI, like things you'd like to see? Like things that have like been like, ah, you know, man, I can't wait till we get to that point where like AI is like that or like drones are like that or whatever.
Good question. Really good question. I hope not. Lots of the sci-fi I really like is like dystopic, you know?
Well,
So
I was kind of mining for positive examples.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Like the first thing that popped into my head now when you asked the question was snow crash, and basically like something that is so sophisticated that it takes over your mind. And we see that happening, kind of like Bitcoin is a little bit like that. You know, you get infected by the Bitcoin virus.
Yeah.
And so on. But you mentioned the autonomous solar powered drones. I would love to see that. I saw some prototypes years ago. I used to do lots of big scare quotes, like extreme sports, you know, snowboarding, skateboarding, BMX riding, those kind of things.
Yeah.
And it would be awesome to have just a little drone that you can just throw over your shoulder and it will like unfold and just follow you automatically and kind of, you know, like shoot some cool things or whatever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. On the AI side, I mean, I don't know. It's a really great question. I talk about this a lot. I think I mention it almost every single recorded dialogue we do. It's like LLMs have their limits. And one of the limits is they are not embodied.
Yeah.
And because we're humans, we're just going to do it. We are going to embody LLMs. Yeah. And I talked with Kelly, for example, about different approach to building artificially intelligent systems is building robots and let them build up world models themselves.
Mm.
And I'm looking forward to seeing that evolve. And I wouldn't mind having an autonomous spider robot in my house, just like a watchdog instead of having a security camera, have a thing like that.
Yeah.
And
was it Snow Crash where there were like robotic dogs?
Pretty
was
sure.
Snow Crash, or was it another Neil Stevenson? Yeah.
Snow Crash had many things.
Yeah. They all blur in my mind.
But yeah, So,
one thing that's interesting with embodiment is that they're no longer LLMs, right? When we talk about world models, we're not talking about large language models anymore.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. So to go over the limit, to break through that limit that LLMs will always have, one of the requirements is embodiment.
Well, see, I'm not sure if they're not just differences in kind, right? Because like the reason why LLMs are so successful at software engineering is because it's ultimately written text and code, right? That they can manipulate, and they're good at this, right? Yeah. But a world model is no longer language, right? And
But you can also plop an LLM on top in the sense of like our prefrontal cortex is like an LLM, but the rest of our brain is not. You know, the closer you go to the brain, to the brain stem, the more different it is.
Yeah.
I'm obviously simplifying by a lot, but you got what I mean.
But I wonder how what that jump looks like. Yeah. Right? Are we going to find out that the jump from LLM to whatever happens in the brain is like actually humongous, and we need a totally different science to do it than the large language models we've learned so far? I mean, you could argue like vision is a good counterexample, right? Like vision actually works great, right? We have self-driving cars, etc. This is Jan LeCun.
But it's still, you say vision works great. Yes, but general purpose vision is really hard because a self-driving car cares about a very specific subset of the things you can see.
Yeah, sure.
And so your vision, and like, again, quoting my favorite guy, John Vervaeke, like your whole perceptive apparatus depends on your value structure, on your belief system. It's like, what is salient to you? What do you care about? And so on.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, if you're thirsty, everything becomes a water source.
The
example I was use is, again, like I used to be, skateboarding was my life. I was a skateboarder. I started when I was 3 years old, you know, and I did nothing but skateboarding. And so everything to me was like a handrail and something to grind down to, and a latch or a staircase. Was not a staircase. It was can I jump it or can I not jump it?
Yeah.
Even like, this still annoys me. Like, you cannot skate on this asphalt. It's absolutely terrible.
We're looking at really jarred out
it's
asphalt.
It's like a gravel. It's a gravel road, basically, you know? And so that's still, this perceptive structure is still inside me. And I notice all these kind of things because I'm still a skateboarder. My soul is still skateboarding.
Sure.
I'm not anymore. I'm too old. But perception is super tricky. So this will be very interesting to see, and like from a cognitive science perspective, we know that it will be very different than the world of LLMs we have now, but it will also be necessary because the one thing that LLMs can't do at all is care about the information they are processing.
Yeah.
We care about the information we're processing because we don't want to die, and we care about ourselves, we care about our kids, we care about society, we care about the true, the good, and the beautiful, and so on.
Yeah.
And so one challenge will be, how do you make any artificial intelligence system care about itself and the world, and so on. So it's going to be a long journey. We're not at the end of the, you know, singularity might be near, but it's not as near as Silicon Valley bros would like you to believe.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting part is that we'll get to bootstrap LLMs to write the code to build the world models and embodied AI.
We're definitely on an exponential, and we'll see.
Chaos is a ladder or whatever.
We'll see where it goes. But yeah, I'd be interested in kind of your thoughts on Noster and some of the things that we touched on in the first week of the cohort. Like, you're a new participant, it's been your first week. There was a lot of, like, we went very broad, kind of, you know, like lots of different Noster primitives. Naplets were a big part of the first week, since Sandwich had the Naplet workshop on Wednesday. Fantastic. Yep. I really like it.
Best workshop I've ever been to, in the sense of, like, everybody got it all running and we all shipped it within like half an hour. It was crazy.
80% success rate of the people that were there.
Yeah.
It was really good. Obviously, lots of FIPS talk, and that's I kind of want to pick your brain about. Since you come from the network world, we went really deep into ASMAP and, you know, what is the issue with IP addresses and clustering and all those kind of things.
Yeah.
And what are your thoughts on FIPS, and what do you know about it up to now? And are you excited about it? Do you think it's stupid? Like, talk to me about it.
So I love the idea. I haven't evaluated like the technical internals, not just like only like surface level. And I've messed with it slightly, but it's interesting because you could basically do an introduction to FIPS by describing ASMAP. Right. You know, if you have FIPS, well, none of the ASMAP problem
exists.
Yeah. Right. And so you don't need ASMAP as a solution, which is really cool.
Yeah.
Like FIPS is this idea that you can create an overlay and skip DNS and point and create an internet between cryptographically.
Skip IP, Steve.
I don't really get. Like, I mean, yes, you're obviously routing towards an IPv6 address, or is that just locally?
No, you don't have to. You can also route to an NPUP.
But the IPv6
the IPv6 just comes in to make it compatible with the existing internet.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so I don't quite follow how that works. I need to sit down with Aryan and...
Let's say you only have LoRa devices, so whatever, and like you pick your thing.
Pick your radio. Yes, you can pick radio.
Yeah.
But if you're using the internet,
but then you just go to radio to radio. IP addresses don't even factor. Obrigado. You can just, you know, you run into a guy who wants to sell you muscles. That's one of the benefits of being on an island.
It's true. Not bad.
Very fresh. He just got it.
Infinite citations. I get, like, you know, you can have a transport over radio or over another medium. But if the medium is the internet, how do you route traffic if it's not, like, what do you mean route to an NPUB? Like,
NPUB
is in an IP place. It's hosted somewhere.
So the issue that all mesh networks face, all of those new things, is like you would have to rebuild everything on top of the mesh system to make anything talk, any node talk to any other node, right? To make FIPS actually work in practice is like, if we have the internet already, we have compute and networking infrastructure already. So FIPS right now, if you go the IPv6 route, acts kind of as an overlay network on the existing stuff. And and the exit point kind of is an IPv6 IP address. And the NPUB maps deterministically to IPv6. But that means then you have to go to, you go through, like.
Yeah, okay, no, okay, yeah.
TCP/IP is then the channel, but you can use, it's transport agnostic. So you can use a different transport layer. And like what Sandwich tried to show with just using sound waves.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
And then IP addresses don't even come into the picture.
So it's the layer under IP layer, whatever layer that is. You introduced me as a network guy, it's hilarious because I really have very little.
I'm not sure if it's up or down. I'm not sure if it's up or down, but it's basically the beautiful thing that makes it backward compatible It's that you can deterministically derive an IPv6 address from an NPUP.
Sure.
And vice versa.
Yeah.
And but inside of FIPS, all the routing and everything only goes to an NPUP.
Yeah, and there's a whole like magic around like doing an actual mesh network via NPUBs and like relays and whatever. Yeah, totally. So I mean, like, look, if this is as advertised, like this is like we're building a new transport for the internet that is going to be far more independent than what we had before, and that is so rock and roll, super based.
Yeah,
so that I'm jazzed about.
It's a new addressing mechanism. That's what it moves it away from IP addresses. And it doesn't require DNS in the traditional sense.
Yeah.
That's what makes it so powerful, because DNS is one of the Achilles heels of the internet.
Yep.
And IP addresses, for all the things we talked about before, especially IP before, are like terrible. Yeah. It's permissioned by default.
Yeah.
And so FIPS solves both of these problems, and the rest of the, like, again, that's kind of simple, and the hard part is then, it depends on the transport layer. Like making FIPS work over Bluetooth is harder than making FIPS work over, you know, or making FIPS work over sound waves is harder than making FIPS work over TCP/IP.
Sure. But then it can be arbitrary, right? You can pick whatever you want.
You can pick whatever you want. That's why, like, if you go to the FIPS website, like FIPS.network, you'll see a FIPS package, you know, going over the wire, then going over Tor, then going over Bluetooth.
And
you know, on Tor, it slows down massively, and Bluetooth is slow as well, and so on. But it's all FIPS.
And it's
just the underlying transport layer is what changes.
It's like one idea I had that I was talking to Arian about last night was like, wow, it would be cool, you know, like what if we, you know, add another transport layer to Bitcoin Core, so we have Tor, IQP, and then FIPS. And then I was like, oh, well, wait, if it just does IPv6, it already just works out of the box. But you can have a FIPS peer via Bitcoin Core node.
Yeah.
And there was no problem.
Yeah.
Right? It just works.
Yeah.
So I want to test this out and make sure I'm right about that.
Yeah.
But and you can do all sorts of fun things here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Have one core relay for the island, and then it just FIPS over radio to your entire island or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Like, I love the versatility. The fact that it's amorphous, right? It can change shapes and go in every direction it needs to go.
It's kind of a bridge-building technology. It's like you can bridge anything with anything. The Archipelago guys, what they showed off, making the Archipelago nodes that they are building FIPS compatible.
Yeah.
That was so amazing to see that they managed to pull it off. And also, like, one of the side effects is, like, you don't have to care about, you know, like, hole punching or any net stuff or any router configuration to make it connect to these IPs and so on. It just works.
Yep.
It just works. You punch in the NPUP, that's it. You even have a discovery layer, you know, like, you can discover the NPUP and so on. And then it just works. It's quite amazing.
No, so, I mean, you know, you asked me, like, what my overall, like, first week impression was. I think, like, I am beyond, like, I could not be more bullish about the next couple of weeks and just, like, the things we can do on Noster. Like, one thing that was amazing was, like, stuff like the Archipelago guys was, like, yeah, it was just, like, easy to integrate, and it made everything better, and it was all easier. And you see this path, and I've seen this in a couple of projects now where you just do Buzz would be a good example, right? Where you take the Noster ideas, and it turns out they're very simple to integrate and give you so much for free that all you have to do is step away from your old way of thinking about application building, about the web, about centralized services, SaaS, etc.
Yeah.
And all these things start bubbling up that are so, like, within reach and make your product so much better, right? And that's been, I didn't think about before, but very bullish on that front, right?
Did you play around with Buzz already? Did you give it a go?
So I put NixOS on my laptop, and so I suffer with any package building, and I've been trying to build Buzz for a better part of the past week, unsuccessfully. But I did learn a lot about app image packaging. No, I haven't gotten past the interface. The thing that was weird with Buzz was, like, it forces you to get either Codex or Claude.
Yeah.
And yeah, I didn't really love that.
Yeah.
So I don't know why I couldn't just use Goose or something.
Yeah. But. Yeah, you're a kind of Maple-only kind of guy, what I heard, right?
I try to use Maple AI. Shout out, Tony.
Because
I like it, and it's a great service, and that's how I want to use LLMs, is privately.
Yeah. You run local models as well, or you have any type of hardware to speak of?
Nah, I don't have very serious hardware, so that's why I'm kind of stuck with services. That's why Maple is the right fit, right?
You plan on getting one?
Nah.
Post-hype of Bitcoinization?
So, I mean, yeah, right. Like, right. I kind of laugh. I mean, the thing that's interesting with this whole AI thing is, like, are we going to wake up a year from now and all of a sudden there's a model you can run that's very small and focused exactly for the tasks you need? You know, like, are we going to wake up and all of a sudden the GPUs didn't actually matter that much? Or are we going to have to keep gobbling up hardware until 2030 to run the next and best thing? Or is it always going to be just in the cloud because no one's going to have a server rack in their closet? Like, I don't really know where it's going, so I'm not going to invest in, like, hardware.
Yeah.
I don't know yet.
Yeah.
Obviously, like, yeah, the future depends on open source local models. I think we talked about this somewhere along this route a couple of days ago, but I would love to see models, like, trained for just Rust dev, or, you know, I've thought about it for Elixir, like just Elixir dev, and it's very, very good at just its own model space, but also at coding and agents and tool calling, etc. I think you could build really slim little models that would totally run locally, right?
Yeah, no, I think that's where things are heading. And I know very little about this stuff, but I obviously talk to people that know a lot about this stuff. And the kind of research consensus seems to be models get smarter and smaller and catch up faster to frontier than most people would like to think.
Yeah.
And I think also the specialization aspect that you mentioned is going to be big going forward.
Yeah.
Again, like quoting John Vervaeke and all the, everything we know about cognitive science is like you can't be a specialist and a generalist at the same time. So we will need to have specialized models, and the stuff you talked about obviously is like highly specialized, like an Elixir specialist, you know, like a Rust specialist, or like even more stupid than that, like a, I don't know, only
HTML.
Yeah, you know? diff merging code conflict resolution specialist and those kind of things.
Yeah.
And people will definitely build this and also like distill bigger models into these specialists and so on. So that's definitely happening.
I mean, is it just that I don't know the like cutting edge LLM training subculture of the internet and they're all doing this? Like, I feel like someone must have done similar things, right?
Yeah, I know too little about it myself. I'm sure there's people out there that did the first experiments along these lines.
But you know, there was an interesting moment. My sense of time has gone out the window with this fucking LLM stuff. But I want to say a year ago, where like, I think it was AmpCode, the like, they're kind of a harness for the UI for coding with agents. And they were like, you know what, we're removing all tool calling because soon we see a future where the models will be so good that we won't need to do any like actual tool calling engineering.
Interesting.
And then like, a month later, the exact opposite thing was the status quo in the world, where like where everyone was like, you know what, actually, the dumbest fucking models, as long as they're good at tool calling, will outperform anything. Because what we really want for software engineering isn't like a hyper, super, you know, independent model that understands everything about everything. We want someone that is really good at using the tools at its disposal.
Yeah, picking the right tool for the right job.
Yeah. So I think that's the right thesis, and I think that's why we're seeing all this like agentic engineering stuff take off, because that's why I think Anthropic, I'm super bearish on Anthropic for lots of reasons, but like one of them is that their main thesis is that the best model will win. There will be one model to rule them all.
Yeah, that's what I disagree with, obviously, as well. Yeah.
No, terrible strategy, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know, I would like to think that the future is like models that are very good at tool calling and managing their environments, and can be like their actual size is really, really small, right? You need very little memory to run them.
Yeah.
But again, man, I don't know. I'm not a little.
Yeah, no, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, I think stuff, well, I mean, Apple is doing that as well. They are ahead of the curve in some sense that they have all the hardware, you know, and like the chips in the iPhones are insanely capable. And so we will have local AI. That's where it's trending, basically. We'll have lots of stuff run locally on the supercomputers we have in our pockets and so on.
Yeah.
And I don't rule it out that open source models will get good enough and small enough that you can just run it on relatively simple consumer hardware. I think we are at a strange time right now where just hardware prices are all over the place. And just, you know, if you want to buy something and run your own inference, like strong models, you have to buy the equivalent of like a, you know, medium-sized car.
Yeah.
And so
I wouldn't underestimate the hackers, right? They come up with ways to do things with with models that are
never bet against human ingenuity.
And isn't, I know it's kind of like, you know, we have lots of we don't know where this is going to go, but isn't it so fun? Like, I feel like in the next couple of years,
it's
go
a lot
any
of fun.
Direction.
Yeah, like, no, it's a lot of fun.
What a time to be
alive. Yeah. I have one more thing to pick your brain about. Sure. You mentioned it already briefly, but it relates to what you demoed this Friday. So you packaged a bunch of Nostra stuff for Nyx. So tell me all about this and what's your plan for that? And how do we get Justin Moon aware of it as fast as possible?
Oh, I can ping Justin. I started packaging Nostra software with Nyx, right? And so I presented basically I packaged a bunch of stuff and I threw it onto a Nyx binary cache. So if you use Nyx as a package manager, you can just use this binary cache to give you binaries, right? So if you say, yeah, I want to go, you know, I want to build a developer environment that uses NAC or NGIT or FIPS, you know, or all these things, it'll just check the binary cache first and say, if it's there, I'll just pull it down, right? So, I mean, we're all used to binary caches as software engineers. So the reason to do this, like my motivation for doing it was that, software packages are the bedrock of how we build all the things we build, right? Like everyone uses other people's software. We ship software to others. And so we need a transparent tool to be able to manage both like publishing packages and downloading packages from the web and make it as easy as possible to use tools, software tools. And to me, the answer to that is Nyx, right? I've seen the good and the bad side of Nyx, so I'm by no means like a Nyx zealot. But I think there's only one tool that's a true universal package manager that can handle any language, any output build system, or output target, and have like one language and system to handle all that. And I think that's like, that's a necessary, I see it as like sovereign infrastructure, right?
How come you got into Nyx in the first place? But it feels like it's your first love affair, something like that.
I've been coding in Elixir for a bunch of years, and so Elixir is a functional language, and I've been looking at like, I honestly kind of stumbled upon it, and I had a couple of, I guess I just like went reading about it, and I was like, this looks like a total mess, and I definitely don't want to get nerd sniped by this because this feels like this is going to suck in years of my life, and no thank you.
So you were right about that,
so
probably.
So I was right, and it did take a while to get up to speed with Nyx, and I wish I had waited for LLMs to just teach me, but whatever. There's just something that the creator of Nyx saw about how to build software, like a question about really what does it mean to build software and what is the optimal way to do it, or what is at least a sound way to do it, better than all the other examples we have today, which are all kind of shitty for different ways, for different reasons. I read he had a PhD thesis, which isn't like, it really isn't that long or whatever, and he just exposes the
main readable PhD thesis.
Yeah, totally
those
readable.
Those are few and far between.
There are a few. And it just laid it out. And it was all like based on cryptographic identifiers and, you know, having a graph and map of different hashes. Yeah, that created a map, a graph of dependencies. And so it was, you know, they use Merkle trees. They use all sorts of things that are really familiar to
all
us.
All this stuff you already loved.
Exactly. And I was like, oh, well, like I understand this pattern and like I see how it fits. And like does it really work for building packages? And turns out it does. And you get some really nice things out of it. One of them is reproducibility. So you're able to like, if I run it on my machine and we have the same machine type and you run it on your machine, if you did it correctly, then we'll get the exact same binary bit for bit, right?
Yeah.
And that's really hard to do on most other systems or other build systems. And Nyx has
and
like a way
that's important for certain trust assumptions. So you wanna know that the stuff you're executing, there is no funny business going on. There was no man in the middle injecting stuff into your software and so on.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's one way to make sure of that.
And you know, it should be how all software works.
Yeah,
like, you know, the fact that we live without this is kind of like the Wild West.
The world has been running on YOLO mode for a long time.
Exactly. and so, you know, with Nyx, I found a little like island of sanity in terms of how to distribute and think about build systems and building packages. And you know, the Nyx community took this idea and went very far with it, right? It went from a package manager to actually, you know what, we can use the same theory to build operating systems. So there's like a Linux distribution called NyxOS.
Yeah.
We can actually use this to build deploy management systems that are incredibly powerful and useful because they don't have to recompute everything every time and they can see transparently what's happening on both machines, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
All sorts of stuff. And so, yeah, I just became comfortable with it. I mean, I worked for Nick's company at some point. I worked for the Nick's West Foundation briefly. Yeah, I just, you know, and then when I came into Bitcoin, I mean, I'd heard about this project, but Jonas Nick and Eric Arvstadt built Nick's Bitcoin, which was like a whole Bitcoin deploy thing where with lots of Bitcoin stuff packaged. So that was kind of my inspiration for Nostr Package. It was like, well, it'd be cool if we had a similar thing.
Nick's
Nostr, exactly. Where like stuff is packaged.
Let's go.
There's recipes to deploy it. Awesome. You can deploy your own nodes. So like what I'm going to work on next is like that deploy story stuff. Like, can we make a really easy, reproducible way of shipping a FIPS node with a NGIT grasp server with a Blossom drive with Cashew Mint? You know, can you compose these services and ship them composably, mix and match, etc.?
Awesome. Yeah. Right?
And so like the whole goal with that is to make it easy and safe to deploy your own machines. Yeah.
It's also very agent friendly, right? Like agents are very good at deploying Nick stuff. So if you have an infrastructure agent and you just said, I want the Blossom server and I want the Cashew Mint and maybe I want the relay, just deploy it and it will just go ahead and do everything.
Definitely. Yeah. Like the fact that Nix is like a written configuration means the clankers are just really good at it.
Yeah.
Right? It's all text and they love text.
Yeah, yeah. Fantastic.
So it's been also another happenstance of LLMs that they are quite in love with Nix.
Yeah, match made in heaven. You might know a little bit about geeks as well, since we spoke about building Bitcoin. And I always thought that was interesting because that's a very hard problem to solve as well. How can you start with as little dependencies as possible and bootstrap the software into existence? Mm-hmm. Like with every step, making sure that there's no funny business going on. Like, can you talk to me about that a little bit? How much do you know about geeks? GUIX.
Yeah, GUIX. I mean, conceptually, I don't know much about the internals apart from like they forked off of Nix super early and did their own kind of, they took that same idea I was talking about at Nix and just implemented it very differently. And it's what we use in Core, right? So people like rebuild Core locally on their machine with geeks and they publish the hash to make sure they have the same one, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, what's really interesting is, so that works great. And like, you know, people use geeks, you could go verify the attestations and all that. But recently, OXB10C went and did the same thing with Nix because we always thought that it'd be possible to do this thing with Nix. And he was like, can I actually find the geeks hash with Nix?
Okay.
Right. So can I do this cross tool and come up with the same output for Core? And the mad lad did it. So he figured
mad
out.
Mad lad is right.
Yeah, dude, he's such a mad lad. And so I think now we have it for all builds for macOS.
Oh, wow. I didn't know.
Where you can actually just, you get a correct reproducible build, whether you use Nix or Geeks.
Awesome.
Nix or Geeks. I mean,
awesome. Yeah, he's just insane. Like the stuff he does in the Bitcoin world.
Yeah.
It's like, to me, it's always fascinating that those type of people even exist. You know,
he's
just doing hardcore stuff and being so consistent for so long.
Yeah, and he's also, I think he's like picked up the LLMs and he's kind of just having fun. He's like, yeah, man, I just threw Claude on it. It was like, go figure it out, and he did it. So it's more like about having all these great ideas and just
and having them. Like knowing how the internals work of all these systems.
No, God bless him for sure.
So when do you think will Nix Nostr be a thing? When can we send the link to Justin and he can install all the stuff?
Go ham on it next week.
All right.
And I have the plans for it. So there's going to be quite a bit of kind of drudgery work and testing around the config stuff. But conceptually, I don't see any big blockers.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, let's go. I mean, I was looking at the Nix Bitcoin code base again because they have all this extra niceties around secret management and like making sure the configs don't conflict and like there is a lot of, you have to dig into the specifics of each software and make sure it doesn't mess with the others and you just have to be careful with all that stuff. I'm gonna go see how far I get next week.
But
I'll definitely have a demo on that front.
Cool.
Friday.
Speaking of demos, you had your first demo day this Friday?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yesterday. Wow, it was only yesterday.
It was only yesterday.
It was a long day again.
Yeah. Tell me about it.
And yeah, time kind of moves differently. Like Bitcoin time is different than, you know, like real world time. And you mentioned, you know, the whole AI LLM stuff again is like a different sense of time again.
Yeah.
And every time I'm participating in a cohort, I lose all sense of time entirely. That's just how it goes.
Yeah.
But yeah, Friday, demo day. What were some things that are still bouncing around in your mind? What's some stuff that you thought was, you know, like interesting or funny or well done or an interesting idea? What's something that stood out to you? We saw 21 demos, so I have to ask.
Yeah. I mean, like there's stuff like FIPS over sound waves is like pure hacker. You know, we were at the bar just like masterminding all the possible different ways we could send information, you know, like, and to see fun little hacker projects like that is
someone
just awesome.
On Nostra was like, oh, okay, so just like dial up.
Yeah.
and Cheese Armity was like, yes, but slower.
Yeah. But look, you know, it's fun, right? It's like the creativity of hacking stuff together. That's the fun part.
The fact that you can actually do it and you can the other participants in the FIPS network wouldn't even know.
Exactly.
That's amazing. Yeah. You know? Like, that's amazing.
The one that really stuck with me and that hit me very deep in the soul was the Archipelago demo. Which was the UI one where they showed you the thing for the nodes and all that.
Yeah.
And so this isn't released yet, but the startup screen of this like home node system called Archipelago is the first time I've seen aesthetic and design so badass and so beautiful that it really lives up to like the mission that it's trying to embody.
Yeah. Right?
Like I think we've failed so much at aesthetics in Bitcoin and design and really getting into people's you know, grabbing them from the first time they look at the screen or something.
Yeah.
You know, all our software is fine. I mean, it works. It's what you're used to.
Yeah. It's not exciting.
It's not exciting.
It doesn't pull you in.
This is the first time, and I won't spoil it because people are going to have the experience of loading it themselves. But man,
it's an experience. It's like you're sitting in the cinema and like the THX sound plays or something. Bro. You're ready.
And it was, you know, it was also something different, something I had never seen before.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's cool. That's very cool. And
I told them 6 months ago already, please release it. It's so polished already. Like, please make it available to the public. And they're like, no, there's still some rough edges.
Yeah.
So there are some perfectionists at work here.
Well, that's the thing. Like, it's not, you know.
They promised me now July 31st, right? I think is what they said.
I thought you said October 31st.
October 31st. No? God damn it. Yeah. Rug pulled by a month again. But okay, I'll take it. October 31st.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, I don't see it as perfectionism, right? I mean, it's like, it's obviously like really amazing top shelf work by far. But it's, I think as engineers, we often think about the systems themselves and like the techniques behind it and the how it works. And oh, look at it. Isn't it amazing that it works?
Mm.
But the rest of the world doesn't glom on to things or doesn't appropriate things for themselves because of the rational merits of it.
This is aesthetics.
It's aesthetics.
Yeah.
And like, you know, we fail to communicate the badassery.
It's cypherpunk aesthetics. Yeah. Like it's cypherpunk self-sovereign aesthetics is what Archipelago.
Yeah. 100%. And it's one of the first times I've really seen it.
Yeah.
You know, I could honestly, I don't know many good examples of cypherpunk aesthetics that were properly designed and communicated that well.
Yeah, right? Shout out to Zaza. He's the main designer behind this. Like, he makes all this work and pretty and like he comes from the UI world. And he started with Flash animations, you know?
Nice.
Like those, this era of the internet where we saw more of these kind of flashy intro heavy websites and so on.
So
that definitely comes through. I'm very excited to see it progress. Like, I've known about the project for quite a while now, and it's amazing to me how well it works. And it's also, like you said, you know, the design and the aesthetics of it is top notch. And I'm very much looking forward to it being out in the wild and other people like getting up and running with it, and we see some Archipelago nodes pop up. And right now it's internal testing. I think they mentioned the cohort will get, you know, like exclusive access in terms of testing and just running it for ourselves. And yeah, a little bit over a month from now, it will be hopefully out in the world.
Nice.
So, yeah, really cool.
One of my favorite Node projects, and I didn't even know about it until yesterday.
It's crazy. Yeah, it's really cool. What else stood out to you?
Let's see, what else? What else was? What else happened yesterday? I can't keep up with Pablo, man. He demoed three projects in 4 minutes. It was crazy. So this was pretty cool, actually. So Pablo demoed this thing that was basically how to compose different filters together.
Yeah.
And so the backend can compose them intelligently. So basically it was a UI where you can take, you know, I want long form notes from this person, but also, you know, single notes from this other person.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, right, and just throw them into one bucket. And then, you know, the event starts streaming to you in a given way.
Long form notes from someone I follow, but is blocked by VHF.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So really, kind of really things. Arbitrary composition of filters. And so it was drag and drop, right? Which I don't think is the right UI for it. I think, because I don't think anybody wants to sit there dragging and dropping
filters. No, it was just a demo. Yeah.
But I can see it as a speech thing, right? And say, just give me, all right, hey, good morning, Noster. Like, get me, you know, the last memes by Corndelorian or whatever, but nothing, you know, only the things that got zapped or whatever. And also give me anything about the World Cup and anything happening on Madeira. Boom.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that'll be something that a speech UI like that will be. But you got to design the backend to be intelligent enough to compose them and stream them back. And
That's what he's building out, in the sense that it's infinitely composable. And depending on, I mean, I think you like it because you come from the functional programming side, right? Like very similar idea. And then the output of the whole function is of a certain kind, let's say like a list of profiles or a list of kind one nodes or a list of whatever. And depending on the kind, the way you display it, it's going to be different. Like a list of images is just going to be a gallery, those kind of things.
Cool.
And the part that's tricky is you can also nest kinds, which means you have to nest representations, because you can have a kind one node that mentions an article, for example, or embeds an article, you know, and all those kind of things. And then it gets tricky. So that's what he's currently banging his head against, because then you need, dependent on the representation context, you need a different kind of representation for the thing. Like if I embed an article, you don't want to see the whole article. You might want to have the article name, you know, or how do you display a profile when it's just mentioned in a kind one is different to how you show a profile if it's part of a block list, for example, or whatever.
That's interesting for sure.
Yeah, it's an interesting problem. But the whole system already works, like the composability and the kind of like how it's basically relay filters but composed and queries composed infinitely deep.
And the cool thing you could do on top of that is like then start having arbitrary queries, right? Say, okay, give me anything that mentions X, but nothing that mentions Y.
Yeah.
And then you're running not SQL, but you're running some kind of query on top of a composable query of the actual.
Yeah, and it's extremely performant as well. Like it was quite impressive. Yeah, he's always cooking up something crazy. Let's see where that goes.
Yeah, and you know, it's a whole class of things I've always thought that's really well suited to Noster, because you can't query Twitter. Like unless you pay for the API. You know, everybody's experience with Twitter would be so much better if you could just like compose your own UIs over it or whatever. And I think once people get that composability and the tools you can build on top of Noster, I think it'll be a really big unlock.
Yeah. I mean, and it's already happening. Like the Noster, we have, you know, more Noster clients than users, basically. And some of them are really different.
I think we built a little too hard.
And on the Twitter side, lots of people use NoteDeck, you know, and lots of people use alternative Twitter clients, but unfortunately, of course, they shut all that down basically with restricting the API access. But that's all just an incentive scheme, you know, they need to squeeze the users, keep them in, make money somehow, and so on. That's just how it goes.
No, I think when finally people wander into the Noster tent, they'll be kind of like, you guys built what? Like, holy shit. It'll be fun.
Yeah, lots of things going on.
What else happened yesterday that was cool? I feel bad now. I'm like blanking on all the awesome projects. But I mean, one that was cool was the data one. So why don't we have data sets as like Blossom bits, and you can just query for data sets over Noster? which is a super obvious one. But there, I mean, there's some technical things you got to figure out with, like, to use Parquet as a data format,
exactly,
and how you compose chunks and all that stuff. But ultimately, like, I would love to have a public data repo, and it's just like stuff I can compose and query and cross-reference over Nostr. Like, it makes total sense.
Yeah, that was WhisperHash. That was his demo, and I spoke to him today about it, actually. And he'll get it done for sure. Like, he's highly motivated, and his main concern is he still has too many blind spots in terms of Nostr technicalities, like how to structure the events right and so on. But I told him, like, you know, all the right people are here.
Yeah, yeah. No,
we're gonna talk to Hazard, talk to Pablo. It's like you're Gucci.
You guys in a room.
Yeah, you're fine. You're fine. It's not an issue.
You'll come out a Nostr expert. and that's a good example of someone who's like a data person and like a specialist. And so you throw him at a specific thing you want in Nostr, and we'll get something great out of it.
Yeah.
Very excited.
Yeah.
Help me jog my memory here. What else was cool that yesterday?
What surprised me was kind of the FIPS world map. That was really, really surprising to me.
How could I forget? Dude, this was mind-blowing. So this was basically, like, I thought FIPS was like 12 nodes. And there was, what, 2,500?
Yeah, 2000? Something like that. Way more than you would think.
And so it was a live globe of, like, all the active FIPS connections. I think Aryan, like, must have just given a talk or something, and, like, everyone has gone off and tried it, because this thing just blew up. Like, it's crazy. Crazy.
Yeah. I still don't know what happened or why there are so many nodes. Someone mentioned it's probably Marty Malmy's Nostr VPN, which basically bundles a FIPS node.
No way he's got, like, even 1,000, right?
I don't know. Like, I don't have a working theory for why there are so many. There are way more than I would have expected. I think Jonathan might be unhappy about this, because the last time I spoke to him, he mentioned, like, there's way too many people using this thing. It's not ready. Everything will break.
It feels
like it just gets worse by the minute in terms of, like, people are actually adopting it.
I mean, this will only spur him to dev faster. Like, I see no downsides here.
Yeah. And what else did we have? We had some fun ones, like the Nostr Tamagotchi thing that can potentially kill itself.
Yeah. I was like, that's fine, man. But, you know, like, we live in Europe, and, like, I'm very, you know, like, the France is, like, forcing social media for kids, or doing identity verification
for
this stuff.
Yeah, sure.
And I'm like, I want to build the, like, infra stuff that matters, so that we escape, we have all the tools
escape
to
the
escape
the
shit. Escape the gulags, right? Yeah. So, you know, all, you know, respect to whoever built that. I won't be building Tamagotchis, you know. I think there's lots of important.
It would be a nice tagline, like anti-gulag technology.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'm not disappointed. I'm just like, I can't believe
it. That's the real AGI, anti-gulag infrastructure.
Yeah. But, like, I want young hackers to come out and be like, how do I escape this shit of this country making all these stupid decisions about my use of the computer and social media?
Yeah.
And I want them to, like, wander in and have, like, a vibrant tool set, ideas, and people building in it.
Yeah.
And they see that it's not just, like, you know, four hackers somewhere off in wherever.
Yeah.
That kind of got a side project that sort of works. Right?
Yeah.
So I'm kind of feeling the pressure to, like, run fast and build the stuff we need to build.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Build the escape hatches.
Yeah.
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 What's your take on the future in general? Like, the next, I don't know, 5 years, 10 years, speaking of European Union decisions and the digital gulags we find ourselves in.
Well, it's never been a better time to be a cypherpunk. But I think I'll just quote Hunter S. Thompson when he said, when the going gets weird, the weird turn pro. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's such a weird time to be alive, and so many things are changing so quickly.
Yeah.
But that's kind of all I got.
Yeah.
Know, I'm along for the ride.
Yeah. You have kids yet?
No.
Not yet?
No kids.
Want to have kids or no? Not sure yet?
We'll see.
No comment?
No comment.
Because that's kind of...
It changes your vision of the future?
Yeah. For me, obviously, supercharges my kind of enthusiasm and motivation to actually get this right and build something that my kids can use, that no one else can, you know, take away from them or shut down or whatever.
Yeah.
And I grew up in a free and open internet mostly. And I watched you know, with dismay, kind of things get really weird and the doors closing in and yeah, just most things going to shit. And I mean, obviously everyone knows and everyone realizes kind of the conundrum we're in. Cory Doctorow, for example, wrote the book on shitification, you know, I think it's a nice term.
Yeah.
Like how every single online thing kind of slowly but surely turned to shit. And yeah, I don't want to see my kids grow up in the gulags, digital or otherwise. So yeah, I'm highly motivated to keep working on this stuff and, you know, hopefully help it along a little bit and push things in the right direction a little bit. So yeah, I mean, for me, it's clear my kids won't have a bank account, for example. Mm. They're 3 and 6 now. So they're not going to need a bank account, especially my family. Like the last couple of years, we moved to Madeira because there's a Bitcoin circular economy here, basically. Mm-hmm. And you can live on the Bitcoin standard. So, you know, like if push comes to shove, I still have a bank account, but I hardly use it. And I want to maneuver myself into a position where I can just always fully live off Bitcoin and my kids will be by default in the same position, basically. And yeah, the same for, you know, whatever, communication, social media and all those kind of things, like the chat control that's coming, it just won't face me. And I had, you know, the talk with the wife already and so on. Her life is already complicated because, you know, my life is peculiar.
Yeah, she's married to you.
but I just told her, just so you know, like the EU just passed this thing and so on. And so going forward very soon, you know, like the mother-in-law and father-in-law and everyone who still wants to get baby pictures and so on,
yeah,
and pictures of the kids, yeah, they'll have to install special software. Just like prepare them for it,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's going to be some nip.
Yeah. Sure.
And that's
sure,
just, you know, that's just what you have to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, like, yeah, like Bitcoin's only one part of the puzzle, you know?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I feel like I'm very worried about the fact, I mean, I'm not worried about it, it's just that the rest of society truly is kind of oblivious to it. Like they're gonna let chat control just happen, right?
Yeah.
They're just gonna be like, yeah, well, you know, shucks, what are we gonna do?
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, okay, well, if that's the level we're dealing with, it's gonna be hard to get you to fight against anything else, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, who knows?
Yeah, the general population doesn't have any type of revolution in them. I think it's the testosterone levels are too low for any kind of violent overthrow of the European government, for example.
I'm just asking them to, you know, follow their own laws as they're stated, and they can't even do that, you know? No, it's a sad state of affairs. But I want, you know, it's like, that's why I like, want us to build this stuff and have it ready for the young people that come in trying to figure out how to navigate this world and find out that we have been thinking about this for a long time and we've been through a lot of thinking and built a lot of things and a lot of tools that are available to you to navigate in a way that isn't insane.
What do you think would be the best way to get the young people in and interested in this stuff?
Build tools they love.
Yeah.
You know? Like that's why the Archipelago thing, like I said, it hit me really hard because I know that if you were 16 years old and you hit like, show me the badass messaging app or show me, you know, the tool that doesn't track me, if it's just another bland, like Google material themed, you know, Android application, they're going to just be like, whatever, you know? But if it's something that really grabs them in the first 0.3 seconds that they open the application and speaks to them directly, then you've hooked them, right?
Yeah.
And then you can teach them about anything, right? So I think it's...
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. For me, definitely, that was gaming and like certain types of games and so on. And that's how I learned about networking and like, you know, plugging computers together and all these kind of things. And yeah, no, definitely getting the pull right. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
I think a lot of them will also learn by pain. Like again, just, you know, not being able to connect to their existing online communities because of like age verification checks and those kind of things. And then we'll kind of see what happens. But yeah, I'm not too worried. Would you say you're optimistic or like where do you fall on the line between optimist, pessimist, realist?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm optimistic, but I also don't think it really matters whether you're optimistic or pessimistic about it.
Are you optimistic for yourself at least? For your future trajectory? Landing in the gulags?
I mean, you know, that's a future I'm willing to accept. You know, I've chosen what I'm going to work on, and you know, one day you might be branded a pariah for doing so. And I think anyone that works in Bitcoin, some extent, has that talk with themselves.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
And you just got to live your life the way that you can feel good about.
Yeah.
Know? And well, whether that means you get thrown in jail for using social media or using non-approved social media platforms, well, fine, whatever, you know.
That's just sign notes from jail.
Yeah, we'll sign notes from jail, right? Whatever. But I hope that, you know, it's our job to kind of start building those things that when people come to need them, that they're there for them.
Yeah.
You know? And
yeah,
so I'm
absolutely
very, feel very lucky to be able to work on that.
Awesome. You know? Likewise.
Yeah.
Likewise. That's a fantastic closing word. So let's keep it at
GG.
That.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Thanks for making the time and indulging me. That was fantastic. I'm very tired now.
Yeah.
Lots of walking again.
That was a good walk.
So that was a fantastic walk, and the clankers will do the rest.
Shout out to our four listeners.
Exactly. One and a half are still left.